Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolf. Today, we'll consider three books on Italian food. First, we'll hear from the author of a comprehensive, somewhat quirky guide to Italian food. Then, we'll go back a few years to reconsider a cookbook of simple Italian dishes. And finally, we'll take a look at The Silver Spoon, the Bible of Italian cooking. After that, you should be able to make spaghetti in your sleep. So let's dig in. Gillian Riley is a British food historian and has written many books on food in art. Her new book is The Oxford Companion to Italian Food, a guide that goes from Abruzzo to Zuppa Inglese. Gillian Riley is with me in the studio. Welcome.
I'm very happy to be here.
This is a very interesting book. It looks sort of like an encyclopedia or a dictionary, but it's different. In addition to food, you have naturalists, artists, nuns. So why did you write this book?
Well, I have this passionate enthusiasm for Italian food, and I came into it in curious ways because I didn't train in the food industry. I'm not a chef. I studied history, and then when I was studying history, I got interested in fine printing. And then because I was crazy about fine printing, I spent a lot of time in Italy with my companion looking for Roman inscriptions. And you trudge all over the place with cameras and things, and it's exciting and exhausting. But being Italy, at the end of every long, dusty road is a trattoria. And it was in the trattorias that I realized, wow, this is something that interests me even more than designing fonts. So I sort of gradually moved sideways towards Italian food and the history of Italian food.
This is a very big book. And I don't know, how many entries? 1,000 entries?
I didn't count. It was too scary.
But it must have taken a huge amount of research.
Yes, it did, and years of work. And my poor, long-suffering publishers, as I missed deadline after deadline, wondered if it was ever going to come to an end.
When you set out to organize this book, what was the organizing principle? What did you hope to give the reader?
Well, what the publishers hoped I'd give the reader was a checklist of headwords, so that before I even started writing, they had the complete list of subjects to be covered, which in theory is very logical and sensible. It helps the thing get organized and under control. But in practice, I was rather wild and willful, and I kept, you know, finding that one topic would lead to another, and then another entry had to be slotted in, and then it was rather organic the way it came together.
It's very charming, and it's a little quirky in ways. There's some wonderful sort of oddball entries. I read one, ambergris, is that
yes.
How you pronounce it?
Yes.
Which is defined as a grayish substance found in the intestines of sick sperm whales. Now, what do you do with that?
Well, I think in the course of being sick, the whales either die or excrete the ambergris, and it washes up on seashores in great amorphous greyish lumps, not at all pleasant to look at. But the perfume is something like violets. Huh. It's a sort of musty, musky, quite heavy perfume. And it was used not just in cooking, but in confectionery and perfumery. And used to perfume gloves, for example, in the 17th century. And musk and ambergris became more fashionable in the late 16th and 17th century than the traditional spices that we all know.
This book, one thing that makes it so appealing is that it's full of history and social history, as well as just cooking terms that you run across today. Is ambergris something that's still used?
Yes, it is, but it's hugely expensive. Mm-hmm. So I do know some hands-on food historians who have acquired small quantities of it and use it sparingly, and even so, it's very impressive.
Now, tell me about the inclusion of artists.
Yes, I got into that many years ago when I was asked to do a translation of the Castelvetro manuscript, which is early 17th century. He was an expat Italian, very homesick in England, and he thought the English ate too much meat and too many sweet things, and he thought he could lead us towards a better diet, so he wrote this little book in manuscript, and it was never published until I think some publishers in Italy produced printed versions of it, but I was the first person to do a translation.
Oh my.
And because I was a book designer as well, I had complete freedom to do the picture research and design the book. So I was looking everywhere for illustrations, mainly of plants, but also of things to eat. And I realized that this is an untapped field of information about historical food. And since then, I've done one or two other little books and the cookery book for the National Gallery in London, using paintings as a source of information about food and cooking and banqueting.
Yeah, it's a wonderful idea. And you do have references to that throughout this book.
Yes. I mean, one of our advisors said to me rather fiercely, "Gillian, there's an awful lot of history." And I thought, just you wait. By the time I get to the end, there'll be a great deal of history. It's so important because Italian food is part of Italian culture. And to find it reflected in the work of artists, it doesn't matter to whether they're great artists or quite humdrum, there's a wealth of information there.
One of the things that really sort of stopped me dead in my tracks as I was reading was about the peacock.
Oh, yes.
Tell me a little about the peacock was the focus of banquets in Middle Ages and the Renaissance, and they cooked it and then put it back in its feathers?
That's right, yes. And it was a symbol, not just an amazing gastronomic experience, but it was a symbol of imperial power and also of the immortality of Christ, because the flesh of peacocks was said to be less liable to putrefaction. So when you have peacock in its plumage, cooked and put back in its feathers, wheeled on to the dining table, it was symbolic of a lot of different things and absolutely splendid to look at. I'm told it's a bit tough to eat.
Another thing about this book is that, unlike many encyclopedic works, you do seem to have a point of view, which I find quite appealing.
Yes, I have strong views on quite a lot of things, and I was trying to combine getting the facts, getting all the information that people would want to look up straightforward, and also points of view, opinions, not just mine, perhaps characters in the past, so that you got a bit more intellectual excitement than just plodding facts.
I'm going to read the end of your entry on tiramisu, which ends, "At best, in small quantities, a fine dessert, otherwise a gross, overrated indulgence. Please expand."
Well, I think it's got an unjustified popularity, and you've got various restaurants in various parts of Italy who claim to have invented it. And really, it's in the long tradition of zuppa, not soup. Zuppare means to soak up. And what you're doing in trifles, zuppa inglese and tiramisu, is getting a sponge or a light biscuit and soaking it in liqueur or coffee or a mixture of both, and then adding cream and custard and candied fruits and, you know, according to taste, so that it's been happening for centuries, really. And to that this one particular recipe should literally solidify in this rather heavy, overindulgent dish is, in a way, it's a betrayal of a tradition. Know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. And it's everywhere. It's become the most commercially known Italian dessert. You also say that balsamic vinegar is a loaded name.
Oh. It is such a problem. For people who know how the genuine article is made, it is heartbreaking to see the commercial substitutes that are on the market labelled balsamic vinegar. And because the original is so expensive, you can produce a cheap version. This is really good value. It's only $25. Well, that's an awful lot of money to pay for cat's piss, which has been flavoured with spices and cheap commercial vinegar and caramel and so on.
What is real balsamic vinegar?
Well, it's not a vinegar at all. It's made from grape must. And this is the pressings of grape juice. And this is boiled down in great big vats, traditionally over a fire made of vine cuttings so that you get the fragrance from the smoke. And that's reduced to about a half or one third. And then it spends a year in the barrel, perhaps with a bit of vinegar mother added, just to get it going.
That's the starter.
Yes. And then in the subsequent years, it's siphoned off into smaller barrels made of different kinds of wood, all of which add their own perfume to the must, which is reducing. As the years pass by, it gets more and more condensed. And unlike wine, which is kept in cellars at a uniform temperature, balsamic vinegar is made in the attics of houses. It's not an industrial scale. It's always been a domestic thing that people made for their own use. And quite often, the first child, a son born to a family, the proud father would put down the beginnings of a batch of balsamic vinegar to mature when the child was perhaps 21.
Really?
Yes.
How lovely.
And it's a complicated procedure. You don't have to do a lot, but you have to monitor what's going on because there are all kinds of microbiological forces at work, good and bad, to create the finished product. And the person who is making it, the acetaio, is constantly tasting and sniffing and thinking, well, I'll top this barrel up from this one, so that there's judgment going on all the time.
How do you know if you're getting real balsamic vinegar? Or is it not commercially available?
It is commercially available, and it is hugely expensive, like $100 or more for a little tiny bottle that size.
So that's a clue.
Yes. And the genuine balsamic vinegar is controlled at every stage by a consortio. There are one or two of them who have total control over the evaluation of the product, and the producers bring what they've produced to the headquarters of the consortio, and then there is a tasting panel which is blind. They don't know whose product it is.
Well, it's really quite a production.
Yeah, and you've got half a dozen assessors, and they have a great sheet with innumerable headings on which you're assessing it for flavour, colour and all manner of stuff. It's very techie.
How do you choose olive oil? There are so many.
There are so many. And it is a jungle because it's produced on an international scale. We don't find it easy to find out where the oil in the beautifully labelled bottle we buy has actually come from.
Well, there's been a lot of scandal, too, hasn't there?
Oh, yes. It can be extra virgin. It can be cold-pressed. All this can be true, but you still don't have enough information.
And do you just buy what tastes good to you?
That's the only way, really. I don't want to get kneecapped on the way home, or one could go on about some of the scandals.
Well, perhaps we'll move along.
I think one goes to a good deli and says, look, I'm having difficulty in knowing which olive oil to choose. Do you have a recommendation? Is it possible to taste some? And wherever it's possible, go to tastings and demos, and then you build up your own preferences.
Who is the reader for this book, and what do you want them to come away from the book with?
I hope there'll be a wide readership, because I'd like it to be a straightforward factual reference work, and also a jolly good read, something you can dip into when you just want to read a little snippet rather than a whole book. And it's like a roadmap, really. You've got these clear highways leading towards accurate information, and then you've got all these little winding country roads with surprises round every corner. So there's something for everyone.
Well, it's really quite an impressive piece of work, and thank you so much for coming in today.
Well, as you gathered, I'm always happy to talk about Italian food. So it's been a great pleasure.
Thank you. That was Gillian Riley, author of The Oxford Companion to Italian Food. Red, White, and Greens, The Italian Way with Vegetables, is a cookbook by an American who's lived in Italy for more than 20 years. Faith Willinger says this is cooking as the Italians do it at home, very simple dishes with fresh, good-quality ingredients. She says she has a signature dish, and it's easy, garlic bread, which she claims she can get on the table in less than a minute. She explains to NPR's Linda Wertheimer.
It's a question of just making toast. I toast the bread. The roughened surface is used to grate the garlic onto the bread. You just rub an unpeeled clove of garlic onto the bread, and then you pour over some really fabulous quality extra virgin olive oil, a little sprinkle of salt and pepper, and you're done.
I see. Well, that's clever. And it's also very simple.
Well, it's simple. It's the snack that the Tuscan olive oil millers used to make when they were pressing the oil. And they'd always have a fire in the corner of the room just to warm up. They'd toast a little bread. They'd rub the garlic on, and then they would dip the bread into the just-pressed olive oil.
Now, olive oil is a big ingredient in this book. And another ingredient that you mentioned, which I was fascinated to see, is balsamic vinegar. But you refer to it as industrial balsamic.
Well, there are two kinds of balsamic vinegar. The really true balsamic vinegar is aged for many, many years. The product that you've got on your supermarket shelf is really an industrial take on the product that's created in Modena and is a really special product. It's aged in attics so that they're exposed to the heat of the summer and the cold of the winter. So it ferments, and then the cold blocks the fermentation. And this goes on for years and years. I have one balsamic vinegar at home that's 126 years old. So you can imagine that's very expensive. And in the area of Modena during World War II, when houses were being bombed, people didn't take the silver. They took the balsamico out with them.
Mm-hmm. And what you suggest in one of these recipes is to get the feeling for what the real stuff is like. Take some industrial balsamic and boil it down.
Well, what you're essentially doing is, in 3 minutes or 5 minutes, taking the process of 50 years of aging in the attic and reducing it on top of the stove, and then adding a tiny bit of uncooked balsamico back to give yourself a little more acidity in the vinegar.
A lot of these recipes are very simple, but some of them, I guess, are something that I don't necessarily associate with Italian cooking. Like, here's one. That is penne with Tuscan kale and potatoes.
What you do is you add the potatoes and the kale to the water that you're going to cook the pasta in, and the potatoes give a little starchier quality to the dish, and they help to thicken up the sauce a little because you're really not making a sauce. It makes its own sauce. The potatoes sort of dissolve a little bit when you stir-fry the whole thing. I think stir-frying the pasta is a really important step, and most people don't know about it. But you cook the pasta about three-quarters of the cooking time, drain it, save some of the pasta water, which is starchy, so it'll give a little velvety texture to the sauce that you finally make, and then stir-fry in a pan. It's a technique most restaurants use.
I'm impressed by the notion that you boil water and you cook the greens, the potatoes, and the pasta at the same time in the same water, just adding them at different times because of the amount of time they need to cook.
Right. Well, so it's really one pot and one skillet. That's the Italian way. Simple is better.
Faith Willinger. Her cookbook is called Red, White, and Greens, The Italian Way with Vegetables. She spoke to us from member station KQED in San Francisco.
Italy's best-selling cookbook for more than 50 years, The Silver Spoon, is now available in English translation. It's a massive book, 2,000 recipes, including 23 kinds of risotto. And if you want to know how to cook a calf's head, The Silver Spoon will show you three ways to do that. Emilia Taragni is one of the editors at Faden Press who converted the Italian book into English. She talks with NPR's Melissa Block.
This is the book that my mom used, my grandmom used, so it's a book that has always been in our kitchen. And it's also this kind of book, you know, in Italy we have always this discussion about food in which you ask if in the carbonara you put the cream or not. And then you always say, okay, let's look up in the book just to be sure that you are doing the right thing.
Sort of a Bible, really, in a way.
Absolutely. It is the Bible. It's one of the most famous wedding presents, so everyone is getting when he's married.
And what is the answer? Do you put cream in the carbonara?
No, I don't.
It's not in the Bible, so you don't do it.
Absolutely not.
Well, let's talk about one of the classics in here. What would you pick out as sort of a recipe that no Italian cookbook that would pretend to be definitive could possibly be without?
Well, there are many. One is potato gnocchi. Mm-hmm. There is a basic recipe, and then there are some variation on it.
Many variations.
Yeah. And or, as I told you, spaghetti carbonara. That looks like that is a very simple dish, but you have to do it in a proper way. Or even spaghetti aglio olio peperoncino with the three main elements and ingredients of the Italian kitchen: oil, chili, and spaghetti.
And garlic.
And garlic, of course.
Now, when it came to trying to translate this for an American and an English audience, what were the problems there? What kinds of things did you have to overcome?
Well, we had a lot of problems. And we at Faden, we decided that it was not enough only to translate the book, but we really need to rewrite it for an American audience. Because the way the recipes were explained in the Italian books were a little bit too simple. And we have decided to add a little bit more steps. And also the way in which the ingredients are listed. We are used in Italy to list them in order of importance, while for the American audience it's more in order how they appear in the recipes.
So when you say you needed to add steps, is that because there were things that Italian cooks would just know to do implicitly that needed to be spelled out, maybe?
Exactly. We always said that Italian probably they learn cooking before learn talking. And probably in America this is less obvious. So there are things that we give for granted and it's much better to explain in a better way.
In the vegetable section, there was a little mini chapter on something called buckshorn plantain.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorites.
Is it? What is it in Italian?
Barba di frate.
Which is friar's beard.
Yes.
And the description is it has a mouth-puckeringly sharp taste.
Yeah. And I can tell you that you can find it only in the north part of Italy. So it's really something that is related to one or two regions in Italy. And it has a very, very short season, so you can find it for just few months.
I learned a couple of things here that I didn't know before. Lettuce, its juice is said to calm a coughing.
Yeah.
And this, which surprises me entirely, grated cheese should always be sprinkled on pasta before the sauce.
Yes, because when you sprinkle the cheese and then you put the sauce is normally warm, and so it melt the cheese. Why, if you do the other way around, this doesn't happen.
The pasta wouldn't be warm enough to melt the cheese?
Not really. Not enough.
So it's sort of captured between two warm things, I guess.
Exactly.
The pasta and the sauce.
Exactly.
Emilia Taragni, thank you very much.
Thank you to you.
That was NPR's Melissa Block with editor Emilia Taragni. Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and lots of recipes. Join us next time. I'm Bonnie Wolfe.